Hey, I'm Ruben. My band and I have a new song. I'm also a tow truck driver. When you move over and slow down, you're making sure I get to go home at the end of the day and see my bandmates.
When you see flashing lights, remember, they're not just roadside workers. Thank you for moving over and slowing down.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening, this is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. An African-American soldier returns home to New York City from the Vietnam War in the late 1960s. It's a time of turbulence and change. Racism is very much alive in America. Times are tough for a young black man in America, especially one who has fought for his country in an unpopular war. Rick Talley takes what he believes the only economic road open to him, drug dealing. Prisoner of Dreams presents a large cast of characters from small-time street hustlers and pimps to Hollywood and Las Vegas celebrities to organized crime figures. In a poignant eye-opening memoir, the author describes his life and times, the good and the bad, in New York City and Harlem during one of the most seminal periods in American history. The book that we're featuring this evening is Prisoner of Dreams, Confessions of a Harlem Drug Dealer, with my special guest, author Rick Talley. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Rick Talley.
How you doing? I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to interview you. It's congratulations on the book, like I had mentioned earlier. First off, this is a memoir, so it's a little bit different for our audience, but again, you've just led this incredible and fascinating life, and you've certainly captured all that fascinating aspects in this book. So let's start off, Rick. Why don't you tell us a little bit where you grew up, and tell us a little bit about your early life and what really sort of molded you, and then we'll talk about other things like the military and basketball and prison and drug dealing. So first off, tell us how you grew up, and tell us a little bit about that.
I grew up on the upper west side of Manhattan, and I guess what they call the ghetto, but we just call it our community. I had a normal upbringing with my three brothers and my one sister. My father was absent, even though I saw him. You know, he was doing what he did. He was into the number game. And, you know, I had a pretty, basically a normal childhood. I wasn't a delinquent. I wasn't playing hooky from school, you know. Even though I did play hooky every now and then, but basically I went to school, worked after school, and like I said, I had basically a normal upbringing, no different from any of my other friends.
And, of course, this we're talking about you were in the Vietnam War. So tell us what happens. Where were you in terms of age and in terms of finishing high school? Where were you when this you enlisted in the Vietnam War? How did tell us about that?
Well, I was. That was the era where they still had the draft.
Right.
My draft was coming up the year that I was supposed to finish high school. Right out of high school, I was going into the service, which would have been in the winter, the coming winter. I don't like cold weather. So I decided, me and a friend of mine, we pushed our draft, and we went in that May. And I actually finished high school in the service. I went to Vietnam. I was in Vietnam 1968-69. That's the year of the Tet Offensive. In fact, I was over there the worst war year that the United States had in Vietnam. And I was in the 11th Armored Cav, and Colonel Patton, the son of the late General Patton, commanded the 11th Armored Cav, which his father commanded in World War II. He wanted to make general, so he devised a new war strategy for the 11th Armored Cav, and we went everywhere. There was a problem. The DMZ, Ho Chi Minh Trail, the Iron Triangle, Mekong Delta, everywhere. And we stayed. You go to the, see if in the infantry, you go out and you stay out maybe anywhere from 7 to 14, 15 days. In the unit that I was in, you stay out 7, 14, 15 days. You come in, you stay in 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. You recoup, get ammunition and everything. But the way the 11th Armored Cav operated, you go out, you stay out 90 days, 100 days, and then you come in to clean up the vehicles, restock ammunition, and get a shower and relax for 2 days, and then right back out into the jungle on search and destroy missions. You know, in fact, we used to hunt them so hard that we used to say, I wish we could hurry up and find them so we could have a firefight and take a break.
Yeah, well. Now, what did you feel? What was your emotion about Vietnam itself before enlisting? And then maybe we'll talk about
I didn't have an opinion about Vietnam before I went into the service. You know, I'd see the news footage at 6 o'clock like everybody else did, but I never formulated an opinion about it, and I never imagined in a million years that I would actually be there.
Now, when you went there, of course, you're in the infantry, like you say, you're in a battalion that's 90 to 100 days, so you're seeing the worst of the worst. What are we talking about? What kind of horrors did you see in Vietnam?
Well, you know, it's nothing like you've ever seen in the movies, I'll tell you that. And I'll give you an example that I basically give to everyone. Just imagine that you were standing up against a wall and there were maybe 100 men lined up and all of them shooting at you with machine guns while you're up against the wall. That's the barrage of bullets that comes at you in a firefight. Not to mention the bombs, the rockets, and whatever else they shoot at you. And you get into a firefight, maybe you break camp and you go out and search and destroy maybe at 7:30 in the morning. If you get ambushed or you run into enemy forces within an hour or so after you've gone out, depending upon how big the force is, you 8, 9, 10, 12 hours will go by, and it'll seem like it was only 5 or 10 minutes.
Well,
you know, and then you call them for airstrikes. First, you get ambushed. The first thing you call for is artillery support. The next thing, the artillery stops because you're calling in the Cobra gunships. Then after the Cobra gunships, you're calling in the Phantoms. And depending upon where you are, you might call in the battleships if you're operating anywhere within the coastline where the battleship New Jersey and the other fleet can support your firefight. You're calling in them. So, you know, and after the firefight is over, you get down on the ground and you go in the bunkers and pull the bodies out and search them looking for intelligence. And, you know, sometimes you, as you're doing that, you might stack up 100, 200, maybe 300 bodies. Other times you might maybe only 20 or 30 bodies, because what they would do is as they flee into the jungle, they take their dead, and they try to take their dead and they wounded with them so that you don't get an accurate body count. But if you look at the size of the complex that you actually came upon in the jungle, you can see that it was enough to hold maybe three men. But and you see blood trails and destroyed bunkers all the way. You find an arm here, leg there. So you don't get an actual count. You estimate it by the size of the complex that you ran into, how many you actually killed by the blood trails or the body parts. And then there's other times that you actually, finish a firefight. It might last. Let me give you a little better example. As I said, you pull out, you get in a firefight, it's maybe 8 hours. It feels like 10 or 15 minutes. But sometimes the size of the force of the enemy that you run into is so big and so well equipped that 8 hours will be 24 hours. So when night falls, you back off and form a circle and continue to fight throughout the night, calling the helicopters, artillery, the same thing that you do in the daytime. And then when daybreak comes, you pull back online and you push forward, trying to destroy their base camp. Then if the forces, like I said, well-equipped, which would be the North Vietnamese Army, not the Viet Cong, then you fight, the hours pass, and if night falls again, you form the same circle, and then daybreak comes again, you pull back online and you push forward, and you do that until you destroy it. And it's like sometimes the force is so big. I was in the 11th Armored Cav. I can remember running into the North Vietnamese Army where the fight lasted 7 or 8 days. And we would bring in on our flanks the Big Red One on one side and call the first cav in on the other side. And then the artillery would drop behind the base camp and so that they couldn't run off. So it's mind-boggling, you know, what war actually is. It's just beyond belief, you know. And like I said, I have never seen a movie that has portrayed what a firefight is really like in no shape, form, or fashion.
Right.
You know, and I got wounded twice. I have Bronze Star, I have Silver Star, I have campaign ribbons, you know, so, and it's not that I was trying to be a hero. We were just trying to stay alive, and you did what you have to do to stay alive. And sometimes
so
they call
that.
So
how many years were you in the service?
I was in the service 3.5 years.
And psychologically, how did you fare out of that? You see, like I say, you saw this carnage, but you seemed to be, you know, Psychologically, how did you handle this 3.5 years? What was, you say you were okay, relatively?
And let me show you the mindset of the military at the time. I had maybe a year in because I was on the All-Army basketball team, and when the season was over, that's when I went to Vietnam. Stayed in Vietnam a year. When I came back from Vietnam, I had maybe 14 months left to do.
Right.
And when I came back, they sent me to Fort Hood, Texas to train. Then they sent me to Fort Knox, Kentucky, put me in another compact unit. And then Sergeant informed us when we got there that we're there to train other people to get them ready for Vietnam and to stay ready for combat in case the country needs us again. So when I came back, they didn't train me and the others like myself to go out and become productive citizens. They trained us how to continue killing and then discharged us from the service.
Right. And so what did you do immediately after getting out of the service? You have this basketball career. Let's talk about a little bit about that. You were you played pro ball, but what was the, at the time, like 17, 18 years old, what was your level
back,
of basketball?
Like I said, I played on the All-Army team. When I came back, you know, I didn't play basketball for a while because I just didn't see it. You know, I didn't even play recreational.
Really?
You know, and it took a little while for me to start playing ball again. And then once I started playing again, you know, it all came back. College basketball, playing the pros here, semi-pros here, and so forth and so on. Going into different NBA camps, you know, playing with them. So basketball was just something once I became good at, I was great at it. So I wasn't, you know, I didn't have to practice all the time to improve, or I didn't have to do this where, you know, I'd be out of shape because I wouldn't play for 6 or 7 months, and then I'd get a call, yo, we want you to play here. I'd work out for 2 weeks, and then I'd go play wherever they wanted me to play, and I'd be at the top of my game with whoever I played with. And I played with everybody who was at my age, guys in the NBA, Archibald, everybody. You know, I played with them all.
So did you have what were your prospects for being NBA, and where and when did this idea of drug dealing come into play? I mean, it seems out of character. You really didn't have a drug problem when you were a teenager. I know from the book that you weren't doing drugs to psychologically handle being in the military.
No, that was never a prospect. It was a job opportunity. It's nothing more than a job opportunity. It was a way for me to take care of myself. It was a way for me to earn a living. So my venture into the drug games came because a friend of mine kept saying we could make a lot of money. We could make a lot of money. And I had just about ran out of the money that I had saved up from the service, and I didn't have any employment prospects in the so-called legitimate world because the jobs that I was being offered as a returning Vietnam War veteran were dishwasher, parking cars, take this $90 a week, and that's how, you know, this is, you know, you don't know how they do anything. The service didn't teach you anything but how to be a killer. So the best we can do for you at the New York State Employment Agency is offer you a job as a dishwasher or a parking attendant in some garage at $110 a week. So I took the last of the money that I had and I partnered up with a friend of mine, and that's how I ventured into the drug game. And the amount of money that I invested to become a drug dealer, quote unquote, nobody, you know, believes that I took that, me and my partner took that small amount of money,
yeah,
and did what we did with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
yeah,
we started out with $90,
yeah,
which brought us $65 worth of drugs, the bags we needed, the tape and rubber bands that we needed to bag that $65 worth of drugs up. And that was in July. And by August, we were making $10,000 every other day. And it
now,
just,
sorry, go ahead.
And we and it just mushroomed from there. You know, I got with a good crew, you know, and it took off.
You know, the main reason for your success, you and your partner, though, is that you weren't like a typical guy that would take a little bit of heroin like that, and there's no way that the amount that they used could ever defray the cost of dealing. So at that small amount. So that's the big advantage you had. You made the clear decision you weren't going to be doing any heroin. You weren't interested in doing any of that product. You just weren't interested in selling it, right?
No, it was just business. It brought in money. And the guy that I partnered with, he used. But once he saw that, hey, you know, this is what we want to do, get money, he stopped using.
Now, you didn't initially say, yeah, I want a drug deal. I want to sell some heroin. I want to sell some drugs, especially when you got out of the service. What was it like getting out of the service in 1969 and coming to New York City? How had things changed? I mean, I know you were only in Vietnam for a year, but after you were discharged from the military, were you resentful? Thinking, geez, man, I wasn't prepared for anything, and now look what I've done, the service. I've been a brave guy. I've been in the military. Is that why you had, maybe you had qualms about doing something like this, like selling heroin? Did you have any qualms at all, or?
I had no qualms whatsoever about doing what I did. It was an opportunity for me to earn a living. It's a business. It's not about saying, this is what I do, world, look at me, I'm a drug dealer.
Right.
It was never about that. It was always a business decision. I entered into this to earn a living, a good living.
Right.
Bottom line.
Was there no qualms? Like, I mean, not qualms, but considerations. Like, not everybody you know, and not everybody in your entire family, can you go to and say, "Listen, I made a decision to sell some heroin, and everybody's going to hug you." I mean,
well, first of all,
you know,
it's a secret society. See, that's the misunderstanding. You don't broadcast. This is what I decided to do. You do it in total secrecy.
Right.
See, that's the misconception that, you know, and I can understand because you see it in the movies and you see it on television. There's people in my family who never knew what I did, to include my mother. Never,
right,
ever told them anything,
right,
about me doing this. One, to protect them. Two, they could never be put in a position to do me no harm by saying something that they shouldn't. So So it wasn't me telling this person, this is what I'm going to do, telling this person. It was on a need-to-know basis. If you needed to know what I was doing, then you were a part of what I was doing. And not privy to everything I was doing, but only what your involvement with what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Bottom line, it's a very, very, very big misconception. And what we did could never happen again. It'll never be the way it was at the time that we were doing what we did.
Why is that? What's different about, I mean, there's obviously huge differences, but what was the main difference that you say that it would never, ever happen like that again?
Well, first of all, the biggest drug dealers in the world are Pfizer right now. You know, those are the drug kingpins right now. And the way it breaks down to the streets at this day and age, the money's not the same. It's not crude up. It's just scattered. Everything is just scattered. Then, while we were doing it, it was all very much organized, crews, and everybody knew everybody, and not just in New York and California, Detroit, Chicago. You know, New York was drug capital of the world. If you wanted to sell drugs anywhere, you had to come to New York. And if you want to equate it to the mafia, that's how it was. Not families, because like they say, families, Gambino, Genovese, so forth and so forth, and it was only five of them. It's this crew here, this crew here, this crew here, and you know the names. Pee Wee Kirkland, New York Freddie Myers, Frank Matthews, Nicky Bond, Jesse Gray, and you know, I don't even want to mention Nicky Barnes and Frank Lucas's name in the same breath that I'm mentioning these other gentlemen. But that's how it was. And the tentacles reach from New York across the United States into England.
Now, how long was it before, like you say, you took a real meager investment, you and your partner, and the next thing you know, you're making $10,000 every other day. How long is it before you're a real major player? Like you say, coast to coast, all over, all kinds of major centers, Vegas, Los Angeles.
It took me and Donnie about maybe 10 months.
Wow.
See, but I had an advantage because I had been in the service. So I knew people all across the United States, and I knew their character, and I knew their makeup. I knew what they were about based on being in the service with them, being in Vietnam with them. I knew what type of men they were.
Right.
And so when I would get on a plane and fly somewhere to hang out and party, I would stop and check out, you know, maybe, you know, would you be interested in this, you know, this is, and, you know, I say, if you think you can handle this, we'll sit down and talk. Some say yeah, and some said no.
Yeah, but you can all trust all of them, right?
Huh?
And you could trust all of them regardless, right?
Yeah, I knew I could trust them. I knew. Yeah. Like I said, I knew their makeup from what I went through with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew they had level heads, and I knew that they were men that were respected, you know. I respected them, and they respected me. And I had every confidence in them when I sit down to talk with them and explain what was going on and what could go on. that it would go no further than them and I. And that's how it happened, and that's how it worked.
Now, the thing is, you're dealing heroin. We're talking about 10 months in pretty short order. You're big players, and you're making a lot of money. And, of course, you're not doing any of the drugs, so you're pretty thrifty with your money. Are you more cautious or more confident? And what do you
more
do
confident.
To sort of protect
you're
yourself?
You're always more confident, always. You know, it's a euphoria. You know, it's like, I'll give you an example. The people who use the drugs reach a certain euphoria from using the drugs. And in the beginning of my book, I talk about this. You know, the dealer is trapped just like the person who's using. And the person who's using sees the glamour in life by the high that the drugs bring on. The dealer is trapped by the power and the luxury of life that money brings. You know, and wherever you go, people in that circle greet you with open arms, and they set everything out for you. Oh, yo, this is so-and-so. This is, you know, so you have a power in a secret society. And the things that you can do, the lifestyle that you are able to live is remarkable. It's just remarkable, you know. And then the other part of it is, if you're true to yourself, when the time comes to pay your tab because you get caught, you don't sell your soul or your family and your friends down the river. You stand up and take what you got coming to you. And you go through your time and you keep your mouth shut. Unlike some others who claim to be this, this, and this, but when they had the foot on their neck, they told on everybody they could possibly could, and then set up even more people to be go where they didn't want to be so that they could be free.
Well, you know, the thing is, like, I know that you were not married, so I think a lot of these people married with a few kids. Excuse people for ratting out, but I mean, I think that there's a different kind of pressure sometimes that some, you know, that federal agents can apply. Let's put it that way.
I've seen it all.
Yeah.
If you choose to walk on this side of the street.
Sure.
Then you have to have loyalty to something. And if you're not loyal to what you believe yourself to be, then what kind of person are you?
Now you're talking about attributes, and I mean, you're very, very confident and you can defend any kind of criticism that I might or my, you know, via my audience. Some people are saying, well, you know, you sold heroin, you sold death. You must have known the lives you were destroying. How come you didn't have any qualms? How come you didn't have any reservations? You know, this is the argument, if I'm going to be a devil's advocate. So,
you know,
did you not have any hesitation at all? Didn't you see any of this, or didn't you see
way? Listen, you know, that's the same argument can be made for these big companies that dump pollutants into the river. What qualms do they have? You know, you do what you do based on the circumstances that you're faced with. Did I have any qualms? Listen, I come out of the same circumstances that the people who use drugs came out of. I chose to do one thing with my life. They chose to do another thing with theirs. I'm not responsible for them making that choice. Can't hold me responsible for them making that.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Choice, because I took the opportunity to supply them with what they wanted so that I could live a better life. It's just, it's, you know, and morally, morals change all the time, you know, and you look at society and you see district attorneys and lawyers and priests and rabbis preaching morality. This is how you are supposed to live. And if you don't live this way, then you're not a good person and you're destroying the moral fiber of the nation. Then you read next, Eugene Gold, district attorney, has his finger in a little four-year-old girl's private parts. Rabbis molesting children.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Priests molesting children, all in the name of religion. So how can, don't stand in judgment of me because the path I chose to live, because I'm not going out and taking anybody and pulling them into a hallway, a dark room, and pouring the drugs down their throat. They made a conscious effort that they wanted to get high. I made a conscious effort that I didn't want to get high, and I wanted to make money. Now, Most people can't accept that, but that's the reality of life.
Well, I also found interesting, too, is that when you said you really didn't think one way or another morally for the war, and you went to war, and as you write in the book, there was people that, based on your job there, too, you did your job well as also, and people were killed. And again, you've handled
and
that
they
very
gave
well.
Medals
so
for it.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, again, you're making a lot of money, and you're flying under the radar. At least you think you're flying under the radar, and probably under the kind of thing that people would call radar. You're not a flashy guy. Like you say, you don't have to kill anybody. You're not really getting your hands dirty. You're not that kind of guy. There was enough to go around for everybody. So, despite what the movies have to say, you really didn't have that constant threat. You weren't at that level. You were very secretive. You had legitimate businesses. You concert promotion, record labels. So you put your money where it was needed in the community anyway, and you had those passions and those people, connections and friends. And so, like you say, you didn't have to wash money. You could just use money, basically. But what happens in terms of, were you cautious enough in terms of protecting yourself from, you know, going to prison?
No, evidently not. I spent 22 years in prison. So evidently, evidently I wasn't cautious enough. But I didn't think of terms, we didn't move in thinking of terms of doing this. We set up our systems, and that's what we did. We worked our systems. The police worked their systems. The police did what they did, and I did what I did. I wasn't trying to disrespect the police by flaunting anything in their face. And like I said, once again, the reality of the situation is that's a secret society. So you're not all, I'm a drug dealer. I'm a respected member of the community. I'm a businessman. Even though one of my businesses is under the radar, my other businesses employ people in the community. I'm not right. Driving up and down the street shooting people on the street. I'm not shooting at this guy and killing an innocent child. I'm not doing any of that. I come out. I play with the kids in the neighborhood. I buy them things. We go on picnics. We did all kind of bus rides, everything. So it's not all about greed, stick money in my pocket, and damn everybody else. If you wanted to do something and I could help you, I'd help you. It's just that simple. There were times that women that I know who worked the whole stroll, there were men that I knew, burglars, robbers, muggers, whatever, so that they could take care of their habits. But there were also times that they didn't have money. And if they approached me saying, yo, Rick, I'm sick. Yo, what you need? And I'd give it to them. It wasn't get out of my face, get the money, do this. Yo, here, man, boom, pay me whenever you can. If you don't pay me, I'm not going to say nothing about it. But I know, you're going to need help again. So, they always paid because they always knew that if push came to shove, they didn't have to go do whatever it is that they did sick from not being able to get high. So, it's not, like I say, I wasn't about stepping on somebody's neck to rise above the crowd. that's what they people chose to do. I have nothing to say about that. I wouldn't disrespect them because, in all actuality, they afforded me the opportunity to live the way I wanted to live. So I had, you know, hey, it's nothing else I could say about it. It's just that simple. They want to do that, and I wanted to do this. By me doing this, I gave them a better quality of what they was getting anywhere else. You know, and there were several times that the New York Times and other newspapers wrote about that dynamite red tape, you know, which I happened to be associated with that crew. You know, and talking about the how can we give it away the way we was giving it away. The people who were using were very happy getting two for the price of one, a better grade than anybody else had anywhere else across the country. So, you know, it was simply business.
Now, Rick, I wanted to ask you, because not everybody historically knows drugs, the drug business and drug dealing and drugs in general are much different in 2013. They were different in the 80s. Heroin in New York City was abundant. Again, you were selling small amounts of heroin, so people in certainly in the inner city were, or everywhere, were able to buy small amounts of heroin. And then cocaine wasn't around or not very popular till much later. So tell us how long this run was before we get around to talking about how they finally got around to arresting you and giving you the big time. And I know that the 22 years, you got 17 of that last bit, so there must have been, there are a couple other shorter bits in there. But
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about actually heroin itself, because I think it's a slice of history that people don't really know about, how popular heroin was, and this is before cocaine, and so tell us how long this run
was. That's also a misconception, because cocaine was very popular at the same time heroin was popular. It just cost at that time so much more.
Right, right.
But it was there, because I also sold cocaine. Because I caught, one of my cases was for, I sold 10 pounds of cocaine to federal agents in another state.
And how much time did you get for that?
I didn't get anything. You know, I was fortunate enough with a good lawyer as to where myself and several others involved in that case beat the case, and the only person who actually ended up getting the time was the informant that brought the feds in as a friend.
Well, that's a good one. That's an interesting development. It usually doesn't happen.
Right, it doesn't. It took me 2 years to beat that case.
Right, right. And a bushel full of money probably too, right?
Oh yeah, a lot of money. A lot of money, I think. Close to $1 million.
Wow. Now, did you use, do you always use the same attorney? I mean, this guy's done you real well, so.
Yeah, I use the same attorney. I use him today to handle all my legal businesses.
Right, right. And
he's famous,
so how many,
in his own right.
And what's his name?
Lawrence Schoenbeck. He handled a piece of that Pollard drug case. He was the only lawyer to get a defendant off in that case. He handled the Westies, one of the Westies child. He was down with the lawyers in Chicago for the Chicago Six.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, there's several books out on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was friends with Nicky Bond's attorney, but Larry is a lawyer. He won't handle anybody who is turning informant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, he handled the Eric Richter case after he had lost all his property and was sent to the penitentiary for the rest of his life. Larry got him out and got his mother's house back, some of his airplanes, and a couple of his mansions back for him because they were seized illegally.
Yeah.
So Larry is a very, very good lawyer with offices in Paris, California, across the country.
In a nutshell, how did he get you? What was the basis of your not being convicted?
The agents lied, trying to implicate myself and two other people, and they put us in a place that we couldn't possibly have been for the scenario that they said took place.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's a good defense. Now you end up doing you did 22 years in total, but your last bit you did 17 of that. So
yes.
Tell us about these bits and what goes on there. You're not scared straight from doing some time?
No. Why would I be? I had already been in the war. What could possibly scare me about prison?
Yeah. And it was nothing intimidating about prison when you went in? I mean, I know you're a celebrity, you know
life,
people, but...
Period.
Pardon me?
There's nothing in life that's intimidating.
Right.
You know?
So after the military, I guess nothing is going to stack up against it anyway, right?
Not really. And, you know, I did things in prison where the correction staff tried to kill me a couple of times.
Why is that?
Because they didn't like the way I carried myself. You know, they couldn't make me act out of character. You know, they couldn't get me into an argument. And if they came to me with rules and regulations, I knew the rules and regulations better than they did. You know, and that kind of infuriated them. It was like, oh, this uppity nigga. And the last time they were going to make an attempt on my life, another correction officer warned me and told me what was going to take place and pointed the officers out. So that, like, they moved me out of their reach so that they couldn't actually do what they had planned.
Where were you doing time, those couple bits?
All over the state of New York, all over. Wherever they had a bed, they sent you. You know, Green Haven, Sing Sing, Auburn, Clinton, Attica.
So just different places, they process you, assess you, and then...
Yeah, you know, they don't like
to
keep you... They move you around, you know.
Hmm.
Yeah, they move you around. And actually, I was in Comstock, and I hated Comstock. Because Comstock was so, so dirty. I mean, filthy. When you pull up on Comstock, you look like you're going back in time to medieval days. And I got in there, all of those rats and mice roaming around, and I'm like, you sit down and eat, and you got roaches in your food, and you in your locker, in your cell, you got mice that don't run from you. They hide in your boots, and you go to put your boot on, and you're stepping on one. So, you know, I got tired of that. So one morning, I didn't even go to breakfast. I just got up and went and stood in the counselor line. First one in the line, went in there and told my counselor, I want to get out of here. He said, "Who's bothering you? Tell me what's going on. We can protect you."
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing. complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
I said, bothering me? I said, ain't nobody bothering me. Are you crazy? I said, this place is filthy. I want to get out of here. I said, I don't care where you send me. Just get me out of here. He said, he told me no, I couldn't leave. 2 weeks later, they shipped me out. I was happy to get out of there. Then another time, I had asked my counselor, could I go to Attica? He says, nobody asked to go to Attica.
Yeah.
What's going on? Why you want to go to Attica? Listen, man, it's a jail. Send me to Attica. You know, I have some friends up there. Go up there and hang out with them for a couple of years. I wasn't trying to avoid some place because they were saying this place is hard or this place is. I didn't care. I'm in prison. It's a bed. You gonna lock me in that cell at 9 o'clock at night? And at 7 o'clock in the morning, you're going to crack it and send me to breakfast. So Attica, Clinton, Greenhaven, Comstock is the only place I didn't want to be. And that's because it was filthy. But any other prison where you talking about it was tough and it's this and it's that, I didn't care where you sent me. It didn't make no difference. I couldn't go home. I couldn't go see my girl. I couldn't go see my son. I couldn't go hang out with my brothers. I couldn't see my mother. You know, so prison is prison. One is not tougher than the other.
Now, let's get around to talking about how they finally ensnare you and send you to prison for a long bit. And tell us a little bit about that, because that was a surprise, I'm sure. Tell us how they finally do get you, and are there federal charges? And tell us about why this is such a big trial. You've done a little bit of time before. You've gotten other charges. How come so big now? And was
well, you know,
how much of a surprise?
Well, you know, each time that they caught me, it was a big, for a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
But the lawyer, Larry, always chopped the charges, the indictment charges down. And one thing they always do is they over-indict.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you get caught with coming out of a building or going into a building and you have drugs, one of the charges you're going to get, trespassing, burglary, criminal trespass. So you have the drug charge, you'll be indicted maybe 10 different ways on the drug charge. Then for being where you are in a known drug spot or whatever, you'll get 10 different indictments, counts on indictment for that. So
sure.
In all actuality, you walking into a building with a kilo, 2 kilos, five, whatever it is that they catch you with. You have an ordinary person will look at that and go, well, he had X amount of drugs. But when the indictment comes out, you'll have 75 counts on the indictment.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they stacked the indictment. And that sure. makes it almost virtually impossible for you to beat every charge. But when you have a good lawyer, they work to knock the top counts off the indictment. And then when you get down to the lesser counts on the indictment, they try to make sure they can keep enough so they can add up enough years so that you can stay gone for a good period of time. But then again, it's in the hands of the lawyer. If you have a proper attorney, then those counts can be whittled down too, where as opposed to you doing 25 years, you might do 6 or 4. So, you know, it's how they stack the indictment.
How long
you're going to go away for and what you're going to actually be convicted of. And, you know, a lawyer who is court worthy will always get you, if not completely off, the least amount of time.
So what actually happened that you were looking at a huge sentence for once? How did they get enough evidence against you? What were the circumstances?
The amount of money that they could not find that disappeared, that came from an undercover buy, that got me the time.
How much money are we talking?
It was $422,000 that disappeared.
Well, tell us the circumstances of the arrest and the setup.
I came from seeing a certain person who didn't get arrested, made the arrangements, which one of them happened to be undercover, a husband and wife team, gave me the money, I made arrangements with someone else to see them at another time with what they asked for.
Mm-hmm.
When certain things didn't take place because certain elements of their team jumped the gun and snatched other people up before anything actually took place, and only one transaction had taken place was them handing over the money. They didn't wait to get what they were supposed to get to solidify the case. The money was missing. That angered them. And they sent me in front of the hanging judge. It wasn't even in the drug court. Sent me to the hanging judge. Judge left. But what happened was they took me out of Judge Left's court and sent me across the street to 111, which is the drug court in New York. Everybody knows you in 111 New York, you're in the drug court. So they took me out of Judge Left's court at 100 Center Street and sent me over to 111 Judge Benjamin, and I got a hung jury.
So they refiled after the hung jury?
They refiled. And they sent me back in front of Judge Left.
Oh,
and
wow, that's...
He was determined to get me. And the reason when I got sentenced, my lawyer told him, he said, look, you can't sentence Mr. Talley to the maximum amount of time under this conviction, because if you sentence him to the maximum amount of time, then what do you give a drug dealer the caliber of Leroy Nicky Barnes? So I got the second high standard under the statute as opposed to the maximum.
So what was your actual sentence?
15 to life.
Okay, 15 to life, okay. So you could apply for parole after 15 years?
Yeah.
And not and an actual 15 years or 15
an
years minus good behavior?
Straight 15.
Straight 15.
15.
Yeah,
in New York, when they say 15, 25, 50 to life, that number that you get, you have to do every single day of it.
Oh, yeah. So this was a serious bit, wasn't it? This changes your life 17 years. I mean, not that everything doesn't change your life, but so
it changed my life. It definitely changed my life.
And what did you do to sort of survive? I mean, it's the tedium, it's the everyday, it's the everything, and it's the same old, and it's...
Every day is the same, and I couldn't even begin to tell you what I did, you know, through the riots and the stabbings and the murders and the gang fights and the police shooting off the roof into the yard and shooting people and... You know, prison is mind-boggling,
yeah.
And it's boring.
And boring, yeah.
I mean,
and dangerous.
The boredom is like crazy. Well,
yeah. So, but you have plans when you're bettering yourself. You're staying in shape. You're playing basketball in there. You say there's good players in there. There's lots of good.
Well, and I mean. One of the problems that I caught while I was in prison, there was a deputy superintendent, Nelson. And, you know, he looked at the people that I maintained contact with outside of prison. And the people who, you know, stayed in contact with me, entertainers, actors, actresses, he was so irate with me. He asked me, "Who do you think you are?" And I just, you know, I didn't even pay him no mind. He said, "If you," because I let me back up a little bit. One of the things I did do while I was in prison, I was an advocate for prisoners' rights.
Right.
And the people that I was associated with in the prison system of the prisoners brought a different kind of order to the prison. So I wielded a lot of power inside of the prison walls as far as influencing other prisoners. But the influence that I wielded came from a pen and paper. So whenever there was a problem or a prisoner had a problem, they came to me and my crew because I got on the grievance committee. So they came to me and the rest of the grievance crew, and it was the first time that the grievance committee was powerful on behalf of the prison population, because most of the time that job was filled with people, prisoners that the police could wield the power with and influence, and a lot of the times they had, you know, their reputations weren't upstanding. But when I got on the grievance committee and the people that came with me, there was no question about who we were and what we were about. Our reputations were solid. And we did things for prisoners' families and other prisoners, rules, regulations, prison guards doing the wrong things to other prisoners. So, you know, I had rubbed a lot of the prison guards the wrong way. Hence, that's why they were trying to get rid of me by any means necessary.
Right.
But so those.
So you're very active. Sorry, go ahead.
No, so you know, those are the things that I did, you know, while I was in prison. Not that I set out to do them, but there was a niche that needed to be filled, and I gravitated towards it.
Now, you, again, are working to get out of there. That's your main goal, is to get out, and that's, you know, most people's, get out and do something different. And so you get out after 17 years.
Yes.
So obviously you're paroled. You got to be on your best behavior.
Yes.
What do you do when you get out?
I got a medical license. I opened a couple of businesses with some of my friends from Nigeria. I worked with them for a couple of years. I promoted a few concerts. I worked as a DJ on a radio, a major radio network. You know, I just feeling my way back into society.
And how long has it been since you've been released?
Oh, I've been on, what, now 12 years?
12 years. And this book here, again, I wanted to ask this and save this question. Why did you decide to call it Prisoner of Dreams? And how long did this very, very personal and exhaustive effort, how long did it take you from beginning to end, we'll say, in the writing process? Tell us
one year.
And why Prisoner of Dreams? What is the meaning behind that?
Prisoner of Dreams is an article. They had written an article about me playing basketball and fashion design and some of the actresses that I knew who came to see me when I had one of the small bids that I got out on. And also, a coach of the Golden State Warriors came into the prison to get me out so that I could play for the Golden State Warriors.
Right.
So the San Jose Mercury News Parade magazine, where the article appeared, called that article Prisoner of Dreams. So I said, we all are prisoners of our dreams. So I applied it to the book, saying, if you look, you know, and I wrote about that, how I saw myself in the book and what I was going to do, and am I the man that I truly believe myself to be, and I am no longer a prisoner of my dreams. I'm going to start to live them again.
Right.
And that's how the title came about.
Right. And you've been doing the book signings. What is it like? I mean, you've done so many things in your life and so many things that are tough, and you've survived, you've persevered. What's it like doing this? I know I've done book signings, and I really enjoyed them. What's it like for you to be an author, regarded as an author?
I'm enjoying them. I'm having the time of my life.
Yeah,
I'm having the time of my life. You know, my thing now is that I'm earning a living, and it's safe money. I don't ever have to worry about someone coming for me to take it. You know, so.
Yeah, well, that's a good feeling. And Prisoner of Dreams, do you have a website regarding the book at all? How can people, if they feel necessary to contact you?
They can go to prisonerofdreams.com. They can go to amazon.com. They could go to barnesandnoble.com. They can go to prestigiacmediabook.com. Those are probably, and Facebook.
And are you on Facebook under your name or under Prisoner of Dreams?
Under my name and under Prisoner of Dreams.
Ah, great. So that's interesting. Okay, that's good. I want to thank you very much, Rick, for coming on and talking about your book, Prisoner Dreams. Congratulations on this. Very fascinating story. Thank you. Thank you for writing it and sharing it with our audience tonight. Thank you very much, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
I want to say again, thank you very much, and you've been listening to Prisoner Dreams.
Can I say one thing before we end?
Sure, sure.
In my book, I talk about, you know, a lot of people who were legends in their own time, truly legends in that lifestyle. On the 21st of this month, Freddie Myers passed away. I'm not sure if you're familiar with his name, but New York
No.
Freddie Myers. There's movies and things about to come out about him. He passed away. He did 24 years.
Wow. Well, thank you very much, Rick, for this. Wish you the best of luck, and hope to hear from you again soon. Thank you.
Yeah.
And
all right. Thank you.
Soon.
All right.
Have a good night.
You
Bye-bye.
Too.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.